to know.
Well, you don't want to get measles, do you? Happy Friday. I'm Bill Radke. Welcome to the Week in Review. Just a few minutes ago, Seahawks quarterback Russell Wilson admitted that he threw that season-ending interception on purpose because he knew that Super Bowl winners have to go to Disneyland, where it is a microscopic world after all. My guests are filmmaker Sherman Alexie. You ever work for Disney? You ever do a Disney film?
I had a contract with them I just needed to sign, and really? Then we would have had a deal, but then I didn't sign it, so I said no to the mouse.
Really?
Yes.
Regrets?
None.
Filmmaker, author, poet Sherman Alexie, welcome. You're doing so much better than Disney right now. You're on KOW's Week in Review.
And I don't have measles.
Columnist Knute Berger, star of Disney's The Mossback of Notre Dame. How are you?
I'm good.
And managing editor Phyllis Fletcher from the Disney film Northwest News Network. It's not one of their bigger hits.
Right. It's the only one that has a sad ending.
Our top story this week is vaccines. From the Disneyland measles outbreak to presidential candidates to a proposal in Olympia to stop letting parents opt out of vaccines for personal reasons. That is the important stuff that we're going to get to. But before that, we have to acknowledge the Super Bowl defeat so that we can move on and heal. You ready to heal, Sherman?
No, I don't believe in healing.
We've all heard about what that last pass says about Coach Pete Carroll. I want to find out what your reaction to that pass says about you. So let's relive that moment, shall we?
Oh.
Here's Cairo's Steve Rabel with the call.
Clock still moving, down to 36. Patriots have two timeouts.
I have a good feeling about this.
Yeah.
Russell is taking his time.
Take as much time as you want, Russell. Don't rush this.
Second down and goal from the one. Shifts Baldwin over to the left side. Lynch in the backfield. Russell looks, throws inside. Oh, my God, it's picked off at the goal line. It's picked off by God Butler.
Actually, it was not God Butler. It was Malcolm Butler. God would have let us win. But anyway, go on, Steve.
Intended for Lockett at the goal line. Oh, my word, with 20 seconds left. And the 12s are just as stunned as we are.
Sherman, how did you react?
My initial reaction...
I can tell this is difficult for you.
I'm not the hugest football fan. I mean, in terms of civic pride and all my friends and many of my family members, I was very sad, but I wasn't distraught in the moment. I was just sad.
Oh.
So perhaps because I was only sad and not distraught, my immediate thought was they didn't give the ball to Marchand because of political reasons.
Political reasons? You mean his whole refusal to talk to the media?
Which actually has played out a lot in conspiracy theory on the internet, and some anonymous Seahawks have spoken to people about this, that they think there was a conscious or subconscious effort to make sure that Russell Wilson got the MVP instead of Marshawn Lynch.
Oh my gosh, that's good stuff.
So I don't necessarily believe it. I think the Seahawks coaches and offensive coordinator choked. I think they got cute and daredevil, which they've been doing all season, and eventually that's not going to work. And it didn't work in that moment when you should have been conservative. But amazing. It's one of those moments when the right-wing Republicans of the NFL went all crazy and radical and liberal, ran a liberal play when they should have ran a right-wing play.
Phyllis Fletcher, how did you react?
Just sad. Okay. It was very sad. I mean, there was that elation right before when, you know, watching the replays of that crazy catch.
The miracle
where I was
catch.
Like, it had to hit the grass, right? Like, we...
Right.
This is not how we're going to win the Super Bowl, right? This is crazy. And to see it bounce off the guy three times, it's like, oh, my God, what? We're going to win? No.
It was
pretty crushing in the moment. But my mind didn't go to, the conspiracies against Marshawn. I didn't go there with my sadness.
Knute, were you crushed? How you doing?
What are the words you can't say on the air? Because we were watching and... Family was gathered in front of the TV, and when Steve Rabel, for him, swearing is saying, oh, my.
Oh, my word.
That's, goodness gracious. I mean, you know, just right as the play was happening, we were like, oh, my God, they're going to pass.
Yeah.
I mean, we saw that. Like right in that.
That's
instant.
What I yelled. He's and, passing.
Yeah, oh. And we just scream swear words.
Oy.
it was devastating. It was tough. And Wednesday was the first morning I woke up where my first thought wasn't replaying the play. So I had a couple of days there where literally, I mean, the minute I woke up on Wednesday, it was my second thought.
Yeah. What was the first?
And it was actually remembering a dream I had that was kind of unrelated. And then suddenly it was like, oh, no, I'm awake and it's bad.
Yeah.
So that was tough. And now I just console myself with thinking, okay, they've got at least 11 draft picks. It's going to be a great 2015. They're going to put it back together. I can't wait till next season.
Right.
That's how I'm coping.
You know, can I just say that I remember when the Supersonics were the best team in the league and they lost in the first round to Mount Matumbo. That was depressing. This was crazy, weird, fun, bad, good. You know, I mean, the Seahawks proved they were right there. They proved they're legitimate. They could have been the Super Bowl winner if it had gone an inch further the other way. And then they stepped on a rake. It was not awful. It was not depressing. It was kind of. It was sports depressing, which is fun bad.
Sports
depressing. Right, and that's kind of like sports hate. I mean, you can hate the Patriots or you can hate the Broncos or whatever, but it's not like actual hate.
Yes.
It's sports hate. So,
well, we were seconds away from becoming a football town. We were seconds away from becoming a bigger version of Green Bay. So in some sense, we might have been rescued.
Right. Go Sounders. AUW's Week in Review. Sherman Alexi, Phyllis Fletcher, Knute Berger back in a moment. Okay, I think we've healed. I think we've turned the page so that we can talk about this on the Week in Review. We've come so far in America when it comes to infectious diseases. I went into our archives and I found this old newsreel footage from the year 2000. Measles have been eradicated in the USA. Sorry, Red Bumps. Thanks to modern vaccination, your history. That was from the turn of the century 15 years ago, but measles are back. An outbreak started at Disneyland in December. That spawned more than 100 cases in half a dozen states. And a big reason we are vulnerable again is that some people don't vaccinate their children. Phyllis Fletcher of Northwest News Network, a Washington state senator, wants to force the issue. What's going on?
Yeah, June Robinson, state representative from Everett. She also works for Public Health Seattle King County. And she was pointing out that there are 3/4 ways to get out of vaccinations in Washington state, depending how you count. So medical, religious, personal, and philosophical. And she wants to get rid of those last two.
Look, we live in community with each other, whether you like that or not. That is just a fact of how we live. And we have a responsibility to the community, to those around us. And I believe it's government's role to protect the health of our communities. And this is a way that, honestly, right now we're failing.
So she introduced a bill Wednesday that would strike that part of the law, the personal philosophical reasons.
What about religious?
That would stay.
You could not have a philosophical personal objection, but you can't. What's the difference? What is the difference between personal and religious?
I actually looked at the form last night, and if you say it's religious, it's religious.
Right. I mean, your religion is personal to you.
Right, but you're supposed to say which religion it is, so you can say that there, and that's about it.
This is a dilemma for people who, it's not for religious reasons, it's for personal, they don't trust vaccinations. So do they lie?
Right. That's kind of how it forces the issue. Or do they have their child not participate in activities like school?
Right.
So that's an option. And also, that might be why California and Oregon, they want to get rid of the religious one as well, or representatives there want to.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I think, first of all, you have a lot of trouble getting rid of the religious exemption, just given the right to religion, practicing religion the way you want in this country. And the philosophical aspect, I think, would probably be unconstitutional if you have a religious exemption, because secular people also would have the right to opt out. Getting a conscientious objector status for the draft, they had to change it from being a Quaker or a Mennonite to somebody who's a pacifist by an act of conscience. So we're a secular society, or we're supposed to be. So you'd have to make a provision for that. The real problem is getting people to have more confidence in the science of vaccinations. We used to have a vaccination rate in this country of 98%. It's now down to around 90%, 91%. That's a significant decline.
And yeah, because it takes that extra percentage, almost 100%, to get what they call herd immunity.
Yes.
To protect everyone.
Exactly. And this has been, you know, it's proving incredibly successful in places where measles was extremely deadly in parts of Africa. Uganda has a higher vaccination rate than we do here in the United States.
Wow.
Zimbabwe, Lebanon.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You can name a lot of countries. In 2013, 96,000 people died from the measles. And most of those are children. 96,000 people. That's down. This is worldwide, from 1990, when it was over 500,000 people a year. And go back a little further, it was millions, in the millions. Mm. So huge progress has been made globally. And the whole idea is it only works if you get a critical, almost universal mass of people to do it.
Sherman Alexie, whatever the scientists say, if you believe that that vaccine that's going into your kid's veins is going to cause autism or whatever you think, can you blame a parent for not doing it?
There is no debate here. There is no debate. It's like with climate change. There is no debate in this. Vaccines do not cause autism.
That has been debunked, by the way. I know we say that over and over.
Completely debunked.
Was a 1990s British study. The journal pulled it. They investigated the guy. They found him fraudulent. They pulled his license.
And, you know, the celebrities were led by Jenny McCarthy, and it finds out that her son doesn't even have autism. He has some other genetic disorder. So the fact is there's no debate, and I'm not going to have this debate with anybody. Vaccines work, and vaccines don't cause the kind of complications that people are worried about. Certainly they can cause complications, but the fact is that it is easily worth the risk of any individual parent like me to vaccinate their children in order to protect the maximum number of children.
So you're saying you refuse to debate this KUOW listener?
I would just encourage the listeners to do their own research, employ critical thinking, and don't take the word of the pro-vaccine industry. Science is very imperfect.
Science is imperfect.
And I would guarantee you the woman who said that, if she's a liberal, she believes in climate change. So she's picking and choosing. She's walking through the target of science, depending on which merchandise on the shelves that she agrees with. And like the people at Disneyland who didn't vaccinate, well, they use science in their airplane or their car to get there. They use the science of Disneyland to watch all these equipment going on. And I come from a people nearly wiped out. You know, we're not talking about childhood disease. We're talking about extinction events.
Native Americans, yes. If people don't know Sherman Alexie.
Yes, smallpox. So, I mean, and all across the world and throughout history, there have been extinction events with these diseases. These things can wipe out and have wiped out millions of people, hundreds of thousands of people. And the fact is we've defeated epidemics. I mean, it's an incredible triumph over disease. And this argument against it comes down to this sad, paranoid feeling about the United States government. That's all it is a sad left-wing and right-wing paranoia about the United States government.
That's interesting to me that it brings together the conservative homeschoolers and the liberal, often educated, often well-to-do sort of distrusters of Western medicine. It's really interesting. You can look at the zip codes that don't vaccinate.
Well, you can see this in the fluoridation debate, too, is another example where liberal cities like Portland have rejected fluoridation, which used to be a flat earth right-wing deal back in the 50s and 60s. So there are people who on both right and left who have a critique of society, and you add to this the fact that everybody cares about what happens to their particular child. If science is inexact, superstition is even worse. It's even less exact. You know, I think Sherman's totally right. You have people wanting to cherry pick here as opposed to having trust in something that's demonstrable, both scientifically and statistically.
This has become the first hot-button issue of the presidential campaign. Chris Christie said he vaccinated his kids, but parents should be able to opt out. Rand Paul said he vaccinated his kids, too, but on a delayed schedule.
I've heard of many tragic cases of walking, talking, normal children who wound up with profound mental disorders after vaccines. I'm not arguing vaccines are a bad idea. I think they're a good thing. But I think the parents should have some input. The state doesn't own your children. Parents own the children, and it is an issue of freedom.
Which prompted Hillary Clinton to tweet, "The science is clear. The earth is round. The sky is blue. And hashtag vaccines work. Let's protect all our kids. Hashtag grandmothers know best." Shoring up the pro-science grandmother vote ahead of the general election.
I'm the father of a special needs child. I was a special needs child. I grew up in the special needs community. My son has grown up in the special needs community. And the thing is, when you talk about diseases, when you talk about special needs, when you talk about autism, when you talk about genetic disorders, when you talk about all the things that can happen to a child, one of the overwhelming desires is to find a reason, to find something to blame, to search for some reason why my child has these issues.
And autism surfaces at the time that kids are being vaccinated.
And it's desperate. People, you know, parents, you know, create these foundations to fight this disease, this issue their child has. Even if there's not a cure, they're searching, they're hungry. So I understand all of this, because it's easier to find something to blame than it is to say, you know what, life is random, chaotic, and often brutal, and there's no explaining why these things happen.
Before we leave the topic of vaccinations and measles, the MVP of the Super Bowl was Patriots quarterback Tom Brady. He gave the honor to two of his teammates so that the post-game Disney ad said,
"Malcolm Butler and Julian Edelman, you and the New England Patriots just won the Super Bowl. What are you going to do next?"
"We're going to Disneyland!"
Thanks, Tom Brady. A Super Bowl commercial that truly has gone viral. And the Week in Review is back in a moment with a departing UW president and a call for secession. Stay tuned. Filmmaker, author, and shy about his opinion, Sherman Alexie is with us. Crosscut, Knute Berger, Northwest News Network's Phyllis Fletcher, and I'm Bill Radke. And like a lot of Husky alums, I am disoriented this week. We've lost our leader. University of Washington President Michael Young is leaving for Texas A&M, the Aggies. Young told reporters that Washington State is not great to its universities.
"I think we've all been clear that Washington would benefit enormously from doing more. I mean, the centrality of higher education in terms of stimulating economic development, in terms of unleashing human potential with these young kids, we are near the bottom in state dollars per FTE, and I think if there were more funding available, the universities would be able to just do more for the state."
Knute Berger, is this really about higher ed funding?
Well, it is, in the sense that he's going to make twice as much.
About Michael Young funding?
Michael Young makes around $800,000 a year, and whatever Texas A&M is paying him, the current president, I think, makes over $1 million a year down there, 1.2. He's also walking away from about $1 million in deferred compensation. If he stayed just another year, he'd get like an extra $1 million.
Tip of the hat to whoever wrote that contract for Washington State.
So I think the Seattle Times said he's going to get a Texas-sized salary. And it is about money, in the sense that my perception was that Michael Young was hired in part because he was a rainmaker. He had experience in Utah and then here at forwarding the kind of commercialization of research and research project.
He's monetizing.
Monetizing the university. And in a sense, this is partly because of underfunding. And he had a reputation for doing very well raising money and his business connections and whatnot. Well, when you hire somebody as a money guy, you're in an arena where somebody else who can pay that person more is going to be able to hire them away. And they're not here out of some kind of personal loyalty or commitment to the university.
You're making a link between him wanting to commercialize the UW's work and him wanting more money personally as an employee?
Yeah, what I'm saying is in the media, the commercial media business, as an example, your ad executives, the people who actually generate the money, are always paid more than the reporters and that kind of thing. So if you're hiring somebody to a university because of their fundraising ability, you should not be surprised if someone else comes along and makes them a better offer, because they're essentially a business person. They're not an academic. And this decision was a complete surprise to the staff, to the students, to his assistants. I mean, it kind of came out of the blue. And he says they came to him and recruited him. They made him an offer he couldn't refuse. I think most of us, if we were making some kind of salary and offered double or more that money, would be very tempted by that. So
what is the legislature going to do about higher ed funding this year?
You see, that's part of the problem is, Michael Young is looking at Texas. It's a big state. And even though it's conservative, it is funneling a lot of money into its Texas A&M as the major research university of the Southwest. And they're willing to throw resources there. Our legislature continues to fight about funding education, putting more public money into higher education is a continuing fight. The criticism of Young has been that he wasn't here long enough and didn't focus long enough on wooing and getting the legislature on board, that he was good with the corporate funding, but he wasn't really good at the sort of inside game. Part of that is, I think, what I worry about is the UW job turning into like the Seattle school superintendent, right, where it's like 2 years and out. We used to have UW presidents who were here for like 15 or 16 years.
Gerberding.
Or Odegaard, Gerberding. And the term seemed to be shrinking down to the, 4 years, 5 years. Now Young is, 3 years, under 4 years. So, it's just the competitive world that universities are in, and this difficulty with funding them and getting the kinds of money as well as growing, but also then making them affordable to students.
Any more reaction to departure, UW departure?
Well, these research universities in many ways are becoming indistinguishable from corporations because they're almost entirely funded by corporations and simply focused on research and in the search of technologies that can become patentable and become money makers for the corporations that funded the research on purpose. So these research universities are functioning again as a form of corporate welfare, that these research universities become these labs for corporations and that the teaching of actual students really falls to the wayside. And, I'm not going to listen to anybody tell me that Texas has a superior public education system over anybody else in the country except like Mississippi and Arkansas.
Wow.
So, he's lying. He's lying about his motivations. He's lying.
How can a man leave a university whose motto is Lux Sit for one whose motto is Gig'em? That's a reference to their horned frog rivalry.
If you're asking literally how could he do it, I think he did it by backing up a Brinks truck.
Got it.
Yeah, that's how that happens.
And finally, because I can't let it go, Texas A&M is the school that originated the 12th man slogan.
Yeah, right.
The Seahawks leased from them.
Yeah.
Coincidence? Yes,
probably.
I think it actually is. KOW is a Week in Review. Phyllis Fletcher, Sherman Alexie, Knute Berger. So Michael Young is splitting off. He's going from urban Seattle to Texas Agricultural. Meanwhile, some Washington legislators want to split our state between urban and rural, and some Seattle state lawmakers want to split the Seattle School District in two. Let's take those in reverse. Secession number one, Seattle schools, Phyllis Fletcher. What's the idea?
Yeah, totally. So it's a bill that, as written, would affect only the Seattle School District, and it would limit the size of a school district to 35,000 students. So Seattle's right now the only district that is above that. And another bill from one of the co-sponsors would let the mayor appoint two school board members in cities with more than 400,000 people. So those are two bills that are aimed squarely at Seattle.
Why? What's the point?
The point is, it's dysfunctional. It's, maybe the dysfunction comes from that it's too big. So what if it were smaller? Wouldn't that be better? That's basically the argument.
But smaller, does that necessarily mean smaller class sizes? I mean, you have so many kids, you've got so many schools,
right,
and rooms. Now you need more, another school,
right,
board.
Yeah. So, yeah, the counter argument is so we'll have two bureaucracies now and mayoral politics is going to be involved. And how are you splitting it in half exactly? And how do I know I'm in the good half? Because there's,
right,
it's like when you're splitting.
It's okay,
the
as long as I'm in the good half.
Yeah. So one person cuts it and the other person takes the half. So, yeah. How do I know that I end up in the good half?
Right. But Knute, this supporter claims that you look at the numbers in smaller school districts, even accounting for all the socioeconomic differences, she says smaller is better for kids.
Yeah, well, I think the Eric Pettigrew, who's one of the sponsors of the bill, is arguing that this is about accountability, that if you have a smaller district, and part of it is looking at the north-south split in Seattle, which is north-end districts do better, south-end districts have been chronically struggling, and the improvements aren't coming fast enough, or in some cases, at all. So I think it's really a way of kind of getting a conversation going about how do you improve education in Seattle and not kind of continue what some people feel is a large level of dysfunction and a city that's already divided in terms of academic performance.
So let's just make that official then. That sounds like a great idea.
And Sherman, if I remember right, Seattle schools were not good enough for you.
No, my kids are private schooled. This is about race and class. And this seems to me to be making the segregation official. And even though Eric Pettigrew is behind it, it still feels like a self-segregating move. And I know, and I don't know if they've specifically said it, but this is going to be a north-south separation. This is what they're talking about. This is a separation by race and class.
It's hard to divide Seattle between east and west.
Yes. So this is completely what this is about. So is that really going to solve it? Is having another bureaucracy really going to fix the problems of the South Seattle School District?
Well, I can't clarify the statistics for you, and you can cut studies a lot of different ways, but I know that some people have claimed even smaller school districts that have lower incomes and are less white, that they can solve their own educational issues better than jumbling everything up. I don't know whether that's true, but I have heard that before.
I can guess and think about the reasons why that may be true or may not be true. But the fact, how is the funding going to work?
Right.
When you start talking about most of the schools in the north are better. I also had my kids in public schools in the north because of speech programs and other issues. One of the reasons why those schools are also so much better is because the outside money, the parents raising money, the PTA raising money, the community surrounding the school raising money, corporations and businesses in those neighborhoods contributing merchandise and service and volunteer hours. So it's not just about the schools themselves, but it's about the community surrounding this. So there has to be an entire philosophical change that I don't think this particular idea even comes close to addressing.
The other secession news this week is from some Eastern Washington legislators. Canute, why do they want to divorce us?
This comes up from time to time. It's urban versus rural. It's liberal versus conservative. The group of five Eastern Washington Republicans, the chief sponsor of the bill is Matt Shea of Spokane Valley, suburban Spokane. Basically, they want to convene a task force to look at splitting Washington State into two states, presumably somewhere around the Cascade Crest. And this is a frustration that, you know, the political balance in the state has shifted. Eastern Washington used to be fairly powerful, especially in the kind of turn-of-the-century agricultural glory days. The power shifted west of the Cascades. There hasn't been a governor from Eastern Washington since, I don't know, the teens maybe or the 20s. It's been a long time. And there's a culture clash. There's a perception that Seattle is, you know, wrecking the state for the sort of red state or red county voters.
Who would get the better of a east-west split?
Well, that's a really interesting question because the money flows from west to east.
Right. We send Eastern Washington tax money.
And so if you're talking about where the population is, where the concentration of business activity and that kind of thing, it's really in Western Washington. The problem is Western Washington, you know, would have trouble without Eastern Washington. Eastern Washington has dams. It has, much of the Columbia River. It has a credible agricultural economy, which is important sort of statewide. And I think what this is really about is forcing some kind of conversation. But it's not a new idea. Eastern Washington has been proposed that it split off to the state of Lincoln. There's a guy who proposed Eastern Washington. This I thought was very funny. The Eastern Washington be part of the state of Madison, a new state. But that state would have a special corridor that went out to get them access to a port.
I don't see the flaw in that.
I think there's recognition in Eastern Washington that our ports are quite valuable to them.
East-west split, good idea?
It's about race.
Everything's race, about race.
Race. I grew up in Eastern Washington.
Yeah.
It's about race. It's
really?
About race. It's about race. And I mean, these Eastern Washington guys should be more concerned about how liberal Spokane is becoming. I mean, Obama won Spokane in the last presidential election, so they better be worried about splitting Spokane into East and West.
Why are you so sure it's about race? I mean, West and East, you could imagine us having very different urban rural interests.
Yeah, that's code words.
Sherman is patting me on the head now. He's reaching across the table.
Yes, what I'm thinking is I'm patting you on the head and saying, yes, liberal white man, that's what it is.
Who gets to keep the name Washington?
that's a matter for the task force. Somebody was saying that the people of George Washington would be really unhappy if they suddenly are like George Lincoln, which the only famous George Lincoln was George Lincoln Rockwell. So
why don't they call the other state Jefferson then?
Yeah,
George Jefferson, but that's already taken by Northern California.
Oh. George Jefferson, moving on up. Wow. KOW's Week in Review, Phyllis Fletcher, Sherman Alexie, Knute Berger, I'm Bill Radke, and we'll be right back, but we're going to charge you for it. Stay tuned. This is KUOW's Week in Review, and just to review, what we do is take 1 hour and analyze and argue about and get smart about an entire week's news. It's a good deal, and we really should figure a way to monetize this. How much would it pay? How much would you pay to not be stuck in traffic? This week, we found out that the State Transportation Department is planning new tolls on I-405, and recommendations include a maximum $12 if you don't have a good-to-go pass. $12! Phyllis Fletcher of the Northwest News Network. First of all, may I borrow $12?
Sure.
My first question. Also, what is the Transportation Department thinking?
They're thinking that this is the part where you go, $12? I don't want to pay $10. $8? No. Oh, four? Okay.
Oh, it makes the lower tolls look good?
I think that's part of the pattern that I've observed over the years. So they kind of worst case scenario it. They give a range. You know, the headlines latch on to the worst case scenario of that range.
As I just did.
Right. And it was exciting.
Thank you.
Yeah. And so then, you know, it kind of settles out somewhere around, you know, four and then maybe creeps up to six and then eight.
Well, whatever it is, the head of the State Transportation Commission, Rima Griffith, says you'll get used to it.
It's a new way of thinking, and I think a lot of people get it. I think, you know, if you drive in a congested corridor every day, you want relief, and a lot of people will say that it totally makes sense.
Totally makes sense, Sherman. It is a user fee. If you want lower tolls, get it a carpool, right?
I remember when the 520 bridge, the tolls first went up, the place was empty. My then therapist was in Bellevue, and my appointments were in the morning, so I would drive across. And it'd be empty. It was empty for months, and I was so happy. I felt like the bridge had been created completely for my therapy. But as the months went on, it
Sherman, let's
again.
Discuss your narcissism.
Yes,
yeah,
again,
this week.
I'm a writer. I'm well compensated for my self-involvement. The fact is that people started taking the toll road again because I-90 became a mob scene. This all goes back to this fear of taxes. And the thing is, it's universal. Every country in the world that works, every country in the world where you want to live, every country in the world that has amazing infrastructure, that has great education, that has great health care, all this stuff combined, every country in the world that has this stuff has high taxes and toll roads. So the fact is that in order to have a democracy, democracy equals taxes.
Okay.
Democracy equals tolls.
Well, Knute, taxes may or may not be progressive. A user fee on people who've got to get to work, isn't that potentially regressive?
Well, yes, there's arguments about how regressive tolls and gas taxes are. But the fact is there will be people who will have to pay whatever that fee is, and those costs will get passed along. And that's the same argument Republicans use against the gas tax. Tolls being a user fee are slightly more acceptable.
Why?
To some people. Well, I think that...
I mean, should a rich person get to sail to work?
There is a shift of thinking going on. And the shift of thinking, I think, is toward a more kind of libertarian approach to paying for infrastructure, which basically satisfies liberals and environmentalists and conservatives, which is you want it, you pay for it, as opposed to building stuff for the common good, which you would through a much more progressive tax system. And so, and of course, on 405, you're linking very affluent communities with very affluent, you know, a large percentage of very affluent drivers. So California has done this. You basically create rich people toll roads.
Yep.
I think there's just more to come.
Okay.
The Renton S curves are going to look like a money symbol.
You need to put another couple of more highways through there. I don't know. If you're not sitting in a traffic jam, how can you read your emails? I'm afraid productivity will plummet. KBW's Week in Review, moving toward the end, we've got a news anchor telling a fib. We've got a famous author with another book in her. And then we're going to talk about what little time we all have left. Stay tuned. We're still, we're always drawing microphones on or off on KUOW's Week in Review. Let's bring you into it. By the way, we're going to talk about abolishing daylight saving time here in a few minutes. You don't have to care what time it is if you get the podcast of KUOW's Week in Review. You don't have to care. Oh my God, no, I'm missing a Week in Review. You can just go to, you can do it through iTunes or Stitcher. Go to our website, KUOW.org. Find out how you can take Week in Review with you. Now, we're with Sherman Alexie and Knute Berger and Phyllis Fletcher. And this week, NBC's chief anchor Brian Williams pushed his luck too far. He has been telling a shifting story over the years about what happened to him in a helicopter in Iraq in 2003. And this week, a retired Army officer went to a New York Rangers hockey game, looked up at the big screen, and saw a big photo of himself and the jaunty anchor.
Ladies and gentlemen, during the Iraq invasion, U.S. Army Command Sergeant Major Tim Turpak was responsible for the safety of Brian Williams and his NBC News team after their Chinook helicopter was hit and crippled by enemy fire.
Players from both teams left their hockey sticks on the ice in a show of respect. Except, all due respect, but it didn't happen that way. Wednesday night, Brian Williams went on the air and said,
I want to apologize. I said I was traveling in an aircraft that was hit by RPG fire. I was instead in a following aircraft.
A following aircraft, but even that is arguably misleading since he wasn't right behind the chopper that was hit. He was in a different formation, maybe as much as an hour behind the other one. Some veterans groups are calling on NBC to fire Brian Williams for the crime of stolen valor. Because exaggerated war stories are something only soldiers are supposed to tell. Brian Williams, should he go?
He's got to go, man.
Yeah?
You're
in the news business, managing editor?
Yeah.
Northwest News Network, Phyllis Fletcher.
At least take a big old vacay. That's what I'm saying.
Those are very different things.
But I think it's going to be one of those vacays that ends in, I'm actually, not doing this anymore.
Right.
The size of his power and privilege, the size of his influence on the country and the idea of what journalism is and can be, gone. He has to be completely, unceremoniously fired.
That's going to be harder to do given that NBC is number one in the evening news slot.
Yeah, well, that's exactly why they have to do it. I agree. I mean, I think everybody likes to put themselves in the center of the stories they tell. Everybody exaggerates, your Uncle Harry, you yourself. I mean, it's not like we don't get how that stuff happens. But when you're paid and your entire career is you're a person who's putting embellishment aside, you know, it's just a huge credibility issue. Now there are questions coming up about other stories he's told, like back when he was covering Hurricane Katrina. There's a newspaper in Louisiana that's raising questions about his account of that. And his apology raised even more questions, which it often does when you catch somebody, a plagiarist, for example. The excuses they use are usually ridiculous. And I mean, any honest writer can look at the excuses and just say, well, that just doesn't happen, you know. And this idea, you know, they could track his account over time and see how it's evolved. And at every step of the way, he put himself closer to the action. He reported it accurately the first time. Next, he was in the formation. His helicopter was right behind. Then it was his helicopter. Then it was shot down. I mean, you know, the whole sequence of events shows that he was just telling a tale and putting himself in the center of it. Now, that may be a very human thing, but it's not what you should be doing if you're the number one anchor on the number one network in the country.
In case you're not a big TV watcher, this could not happen to a more self-promoting guy. Brian Williams' persona is to constantly go on Jimmy Fallon and The Daily Show and 30 Rock to deliver essentially the same joke, which is, I'm a news anchor and I'm appearing on a comedy show.
Right, but he's not entirely to blame for that because there's a whole structure that's supporting that popularity. And anyone who found that funny is supporting that. I mean, I thought it was funny when they cut together that rap.
10 years ago?
Of him doing Rapper's Delight just like a year or two ago.
Well, it's funny because Walter Cronkite didn't do deadpan bits with a slight smirk.
Right.
Let's crank it up again.
So I would hope that the network and maybe all of us would reevaluate, is that really funny when we see that? And is there something more serious that going on there? Because this all unfolded, as Knute just pointed out, in plain sight of everybody. I wasn't tracking his career well enough to note that this story was changing. And as far as that Hurricane Katrina stuff, it's something that adds a layer of, to that, is he won major awards for that coverage. So they're going to have to go back and look at, okay, well, what was in that package? And was he saying in that package that he got dysentery? And was he saying in that package that he saw a body floating? Like, that could invalidate awards if those are to be taken seriously at all.
Last words on Brian Williams?
And the reason why he lied about war is the reason why we keep going to war. Nobody tells the truth about war. If people told the truth about war, if every soldier came home and told the truth about war, we'd have a lot harder time going back into them. I'm writing a memoir about my grandfather in World War II dying in Okinawa, and I'm reading accounts of what happened on Okinawa, the brutality, the torture. You know, there's a particular story told about a standoff between Japanese soldiers and American soldiers, and somewhere in between them in the battlefield for an entire night, a baby is crying. An Okinawan baby is crying, and the terror, fear, pain of the American soldiers who cannot go retrieve the baby. I think if perhaps you played the sound of that baby crying, if somebody had recording equipment, then maybe we'd have deep reservations and debates about going into any war.
You're saying that the narrative of war is basically, we're the good guys, I'm the good guy.
I'm the hero.
I'm the hero.
And what I'm doing is heroic.
KUOW's Week in Review with Sherman Alexie, Knute Berger, and Phyllis Fletcher. And so let's stay on, Sherman was just describing a book that he's working on. We're going to talk about books now because the question this week was, if you are a one-hit wonder, should you quit while you're ahead? This week we found out that the author of To Kill a Mockingbird, Harper Lee, has another book in her that will be out in July. It's being called the sequel to Mockingbird, although she wrote this book earlier, so I guess it would be a Star Wars type sequel. It's called Go Set a Watchman. It's the story of Scout returning to her hometown as an adult to visit her father, Atticus. And the book immediately shot to number one on Sherman Alexie's favorite bookseller, Amazon.com. Sherman, some Mockingbird fans are crying, no, that book was perfect. We don't want a pre-sequel. What do you think of that?
Well, the book isn't perfect, number one. It has all sorts of socio-political problems. I mean, I love the book. I loved it when I first read it. But she's a writer. I mean, of course I want the book. I want the measure of an entire career, and we only had one, despite the fact that she actually had more than one book. She had a lot to do with Truman Capote's career as well.
I've heard.
I mean, talk about the reverse, that Capote wrote Mockingbird, but the reverse is probably actually far more accurate to say that Harper Lee had a lot more to do with In Cold Blood than Capote had to do with Mockingbird. So I'm excited about it. There's no way it can live up to the hype. But it's going to sell 10 million copies. And the fact that a book is coming out, a decades-old book is coming out, is going to sell 10 million copies in a year, is a revelation and says something wonderful about literature and about our love of books. And I welcome it.
Even though there are questions about whether Harper Lee really wanted this published, she's almost 90, she's had a stroke, and she has always resisted calls for her to publish more.
I don't know her. I don't know her reasons, and I think a lot of people are guessing at this. And, you know, the tone of the articles I've read that take that on, that talk about her in this way, I think are really condescending, incredibly condescending. And I think there's a tiny bit of misogyny and sexism creeps in there, too. Oh, this poor old lady can't make her own decisions. And I'm looking forward to it. And it's a book she wrote. And it's Scout as an adult. Regardless of the actual quality of the book, I want to see. I want to measure her entire career. I want to look at Harper Lee's brain at the beginning of her career. I mean, this is like being a completist about anybody's life.
Others?
You know, I totally get what Sherman is saying. I mean, they have even published, you know, drafts and handwritten manuscripts of other writers. You can see T.S. Eliot's earliest versions of The Wasteland with all of his revisions. If nothing else, it'll have a tremendous interest to scholars. But readers are going to go nuts for it. I mean, they sell, what, 700,000 copies of To Kill a Mockingbird every year now? No, I think it's a wonderful thing. It makes me wonder what Sherman's got in his drawer, you know, in the bottom.
He should have stopped at Reservation Blues, I'm telling you.
I mean, nobody bats an eye that they're publishing David Foster Wallace's shopping lists now.
Right.
I mean, they're publishing his syllabi for his classes,
Get out of here.
The classes he taught. They're publishing the books he had his students read, and everybody's going crazy for that. So it is sexism against Harper Lee.
Phyllis, any final words?
You know, I do have a little of that. You know, when like, you know, the family of a musician releases their equivalent of the syllabi and the shopping list and things.
Yeah.
I have a little like, oh, I hope it's not that. But I do want to see it. I'm going to read it for sure.
We know the feeling here because Week in Review listeners are always telling us, please don't do another episode. The last one was perfect. You cannot possibly improve on it. And yet we do. We're going to be right back. I have to rush because we're out of time. If you have a problem with that, we're going to have to change the clocks. And what do you know? That's our last topic in a moment. Okay, it's almost time for the Week in Review to end, according to the old clock on the wall. A clock that will have to change in a month when it's daylight saving time. Not savings time, by the way. Daylight saving time.
Thank you.
It's not Boeing's. It's not Bartels. So this week, some Washington state legislators said, the heck with it. Let's quit springing forward and falling back. Hawaii doesn't do it. Arizona doesn't do it. Asia, Australia, Africa mostly don't do it. In fact, Republican Elizabeth Scott of Monroe says, we could reduce heart attacks, car wrecks, and accidents that happen because we messed up our sleep schedules. We could have 4th of July fireworks start before 10 p.m. No daylight saving time. Yes or no, Canute? You have 30 seconds.
I don't
which
care.
I stole from last summer.
Yeah.
Don't tell them anymore.
I really don't care. I've never paid Alrighty. Attention. I just do what they say on the day they say.
Good lesson. Did you hear that, kids? Just do what authority says. Phyllis Fletcher?
You know, I got out this prop, which is my Flavor Flav-esque clock around my chest to prove I don't fess. And I do have to set it twice a year, and I have to look up the manual every time I have to set it. So I would appreciate not having to do that, but I can also admit that is the only type of reason that I would like to not have to go through this. The accident thing, I'm totally not hip to, and it seems like really people just find it annoying.
Sherman Alexie, daylight saving time.
I think the people worried about this maybe need to take advantage of that legal thing we have now called marijuana and relax.
We are adding light to summer
relax.
Evenings when we don't need light. My kids are supposed to be sleeping. Meanwhile, I need the wake-up light in the morning because I got to go to work. Okay, what do you think? Let us know, 206-685-BLAM. I forget what the numbers are, so just 206-685-BLAM. Clam or blam, and let us know, because I think we're going to use your comments in our coverage. Canute Berger, Seattle Magazine, Crosscut, the Mossback, it's always great to see you.
Great to see you, Bill. Thanks
thank
for
you.
Having me.
Phyllis Fletcher, Managing Editor of the Northwest News Network, thank you.
You're welcome.
Sherman Alexie, you can come here anytime when you're not writing and poeting and filmmaking and stuff, okay?
Well, thank you. I love being here.
Is something I should plug real quick?
Nope, I have nothing complete. All I can plug right now is my procrastination.
Okay, pre-order everything he's about to do on whatever your favorite website is. This show is produced by Jason Pagano, and get a podcast of the show, and then the time is irrelevant. Your time is your own. That's it. Facebook, we're KUOW Public Radio. Tweet us at KUOW, 685-2526. The Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We'll see you in a week.
Bye.
Bye.